start my presentation by saying that I am terrible at math. And somebody said that, asked me if that's why I went into biology, and maybe in part, but also because I'm very excited about biological processes. And so my talk is going to be completely different from the one that you heard previously. I hope you'll find it useful. I'd just like to share with you some of the recent experiments that we've been conducting in my own laboratory that I think, or I'd like to hope, will impart some information to members of the audience as you think about your mathematical models, and share with you one of the, I'm going to argue, driving processes behind things like developmental angiogenesis or tumor angiogenesis, but we can debate that, and please feel free to interrupt me as I make my presentation with questions or comments, or if I can clarify something. Again, this is going to be a very experimental presentation, and if the experiments I'm describing don't seem obvious, please interrupt me and ask questions. So, just as a way of background, I'd like to give you some history of how we got involved in the studies of vascular morphogenesis. And that is because we've been very interested in two organ systems. One is the vasculature, and one is the hematopoietic system. And these two organ systems develop in tandem in the embryo, at least in mammalian embryos. And at least in some cases, it's been hypothesized for a century that the precursors of the endothelial cells that line the vasculature, the so-called angioblasts, and hematopoietic stem cells, which are the stem cell population that renews something like 10 distinct blood cell lineages, evolved from a common mesodermal cell type called the hemangioblast. As I said, the hemangioblast was hypothesized roughly a century ago, and there's been a lot of circumstantial evidence that this cell type truly exists, thought to be a bipotential cell that can make both endothelial cell forerunners and hematopoietic cells. And I think the work largely of Gordon Keller has shown that such a cell type indeed exists in the mammalian embryo. It's a very rare and transient population, but he has now been able to unequivocally purify these cells and show that they go on to have this developmental potential. So angiogenesis, the production of blood vessels, and hematopoiesis, these two processes develop in tandem and are tightly linked. And I'd like to give you an example of how this might be linked in the developing embryo as I make my way through my presentation. So just to reiterate the basics of blood vessel development, and this repeats some of the previous presentation, but I don't think it's bad to review this. So blood vessel development, and again, I am focusing on mammalian embryos, so this may not be broadly applicable to other vertebrate species, although some of these things, I think, have also been nicely revealed in systems such as the zebrafish, and you'll be hearing more about that later in the presentation. But again, this multipotential progenitor population called the hemangioblast comes from the lateral plate mesoderm and, again, generates angioblasts, and in a process we call vasculogenesis from angioblasts, endothelial cells are born, they migrate, proliferate, and fuse to form a primary vascular plexus, where all the vessels are approximately the same size, and then this primary capillary plexus is remodeled into a mature vascular network of arteries and veins, and the remodeling step is known as angiogenesis. Now, I think it's important to point out that these two terms are useful in experimental systems, but this is a very fluid situation. You know, when is vasculogenesis the appropriate term? When is angiogenesis the appropriate term is still being debated, I think is fair to say. But it is a useful way to think about these things. I'm also showing some of the molecules, and this is just some, as vascular differentiation is studied. The list of regulatory molecules is becoming quite huge, and these are just a few of them. I think probably the best study is called vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF, thought to be important at virtually every step of vascular differentiation. In fact, numbers of hemangioblasts are dependent on VEGF. If VEGF levels are lessened, this precursor pool is diminished. VEGF works with other important regulators like the angiopoietins or TGF-beta or PDGF-beta at later stages. In fact, very important interactions between VEGF and the angiopoietins in situations where you have vascular regression and then regrowth. And I think you'll be hearing about this later in the week. And then I don't show in this slide the additional cell types that are recruited to the mature vascular system that were mentioned in the previous lecture. These are so-called parasites and smooth muscle cells, which provide support to the vasculature. And their recruitment has been clearly shown to be regulated, at least in part, by PDGF-beta due to knockouts in mice and other experimental systems. But the result of these events is the production of what I think of as just a beautiful vascular pattern. And I'm showing the mouse. This is what we work on. This is a day 15 mouse embryo. And if you don't work with mice, and probably most of you don't, mice develop over approximately 21-day gestational period. And so this is actually pretty, you know, a mouse embryo that's fairly well along in this process. You can see that it's quite translucent, and you see the beautiful architecture of these large and small vessels in the embryo. This would be the placenta, and you see arteries and veins in the umbilicus, which is what the embryo derives its nutrients and oxygen from. And we began studying this process about a decade ago. It was becoming clear from knockout studies in mice, from the work in the avian system, such as Dr. Little will be describing later, that molecules like VEGF, for example, or basic FGF are going to be very important to driving vascular differentiation. And, for example, the knockout studies in mice showed how important these were. For example, mice that have 50% VEGF levels, even though heterozygous situations are usually tolerated in mammalian embryos, mice that had 50% of their VEGF were embryonic lethal, very unusual because the concentration of VEGF is so important. And these embryos had very poorly formed vasculature and therefore died in utero. So knowing how important the levels of all these regulators, VEGFs, angiopoietins, PDGF-beta, led us to ask the question, well, what are some of the upstream regulators of their synthesis and secretion in something like a developing embryo? And that led us to study of the response to oxygen availability. But before I come back to that, I'd just like to remind the audience of, I think, something that's very important. I think for quite some time, it's been appreciated that oxygen distribution and availability is an important regulator of what we would call neovascular events, that is, tumor angiogenesis or the development of so-called collateral vessels and for perhaps heart attack patients or in other disease situations. I'm going to argue, and we'll talk about the effects of hypoxia on those kinds of vascular differentiation phenomena, but it's also been appreciated, at least in mammals, that the early embryo exists in a naturally low O2 environment. It's been measured by holographic electrodes, and the uterus at this point has very low levels of oxygen. Just to orient you, ambient air is about 21% O2. Most cells in the body exist at something like 4 to 6% O2, and I could write out how many millimeters of mercury that is if anybody's interested. The embryo initially develops in an oxygen environment that's about 3% O2, and that is consistent with the activity of one of the principal regulators of responses to changes in oxygen availability. And this is a factor called hypoxia-inducible factor, or HIF, and HIF gets its name from its ability to be activated under situations of oxygen deprivation, also known as hypoxia.
Is this true also of avian and amphibian embryos?
So I actually don't know about avian embryos, and I think Charles would argue protein's clearly there.
Oh, absolutely. I think birds are kind of funny in a way because they live on a big gigantic yolk, which is good news and bad news. And I think probably they're so thin up until the mid gestation that it's hard to argue that there's a huge differential across them. But these mechanisms are there, so they're acting. Now,
well, I think again about the hypoxia.
Yeah, but you might think about it like this. What did evolution have to decide how to get the system going? So regardless if it's a fish or a chicken, you need to engage the whole system, and it could be that this is the way it happens. This is the switch, the early switch, regardless of what the oxygen tensions are in the embryo.
Yeah, I think you're asking a very germane question. So our studies were largely, we were inspired by the work of Mark Krasnow, who works in the fly. Flies have hips. Flies also have a highly related protein called trachealis. And the early trachea in the fly, which is the system that delivers oxygen to the organism, is in fact remodeled by trachealis, a close homologue of HIF. And that stereotypic branch is remodeled based on cues from cells that say, I have too little oxygen. And what I'm going to show you is that I think in some aspects, the developing embryo, at least in the case of the mouse, does the same thing. That you have a vascular network that can then be fine-tuned, if you will, in some cases, because cells during embryonic cell proliferation say, I have too little oxygen, and they send back cues, largely regulated by HIF, to tell the vasculature to invade those domains and now provide oxygen. So what I like to argue is that the cardiovascular system has evolved to provide oxygen and nutrients in more complicated vertebrates, and it would make sense to me, therefore, that it in turn is regulated by oxygen availability so that this structure can be remodeled when needed, when certain physiologic or pathophysiologic situations call for this. And I think that this is a driving principle of tumor angiogenesis, although it's not the only thing, it's just one important cue. Is that clear? Okay. So, oxygen, obviously very important. You need oxygen to maintain intracellular bioenergetics. It regulates a myriad of other biochemical processes. Therefore, responses to decreased oxygen or hypoxia are very rapid, and there are many cellular and tissue changes that come about, but one change is the induction of a large transcriptome, which our genetic studies have shown is almost 100%, or shall we say 90%, regulated by this transcription factor. Again, it's called HIF for hypoxia-inducible factor. And all cells sense oxygen, all cells are capable of activating this transcriptional response because they have HIF-1 alpha and ARNT, the two proteins that make up the HIF dimer. And when HIF is activated by low O2, it binds to hypoxia response elements scattered throughout the genome, and HIF will then turn on roughly 200 direct transcriptional targets that make sense with regard to mediated hypoxic adaptations, whether it regulates energy metabolism, either cell growth or apoptosis, or even the other process we mentioned, autophagy. Virtually all of the angiogenic factors or factors that regulate vascular function, such as vasodilation and vasoconstriction, are HIF targets. So motility is regulated by HIF, and the breakdown of the matrix can also be regulated by HIF. Just very briefly, how is HIF activated by low O2? So as I said, all cells express HIF. The beta subunit, also known as ARNT, is constitutively present in the nucleus. This is a transcription factor. The alpha subunit is what is regulated by oxygen availability. So under what we call normoxic conditions, and again, I think we have to bear in mind what is physiologically normoxic. Again, for most cells, depending on where they exist in relationship to the vasculature, this is going to be in the range of about 4 to 6% O2. It's an important point that most of us experimentalists, however, have Normox excels in culture and ambient air, which is 21% O2. So this is an admittedly unusual situation. But normoxia, if you're a cell in the body, let's say on average it's about 5% O2. Under these situations, the alpha subunit is hydroxylated on two proline residues, and hydroxylated HIF is recognized by a protein that targets for proteolytic degradation in the proteasome. But as O2 levels dip below about 5% O2, these hydroxylation events do not occur, and the alpha subunit is now stabilized, translocates to the nucleus, forms a dimer with HIF beta, and this activates oxygen-dependent transcription. And as I said, expression profiling in our lab and a number of labs has shown that the direct HIF transcriptional targets include at least 200 genes in the mammalian genome, and they all make a lot of sense with regard to hypoxic adaptations, such as glycolytic enzymes that promote glycolytic ATP production, glucose transporters, molecules involved in growth and apoptosis, molecules involved in cell motility, molecules that are important for matrix and barrier breakdown. Again, very important when you think about vessel morphogenesis. The existing vasculature has to break down that extracellular matrix to allow new sprouts to form. These things are also regulated by HIF, but very important for our discussion today. As I said before, virtually all of the angiogenic factors, and right now I can't think of a single one that does not respond to low O2. That is, as O2 levels go down, HIF gets activated and in turn upregulates the synthesis and secretion of VEGF, PDGF, basic FGF, the angiopoietins, and the list goes on. Also, many molecules involved in vascular function, such as endothelin, adrenomegaline, the nitric oxide synthase enzymes, also direct HIF targets. This is an important coordinating system for at least neovascularization, and I'm going to show it's important for developmental vascularization as well. So we got interested, as I said, when we saw that VEGF was such a critical factor for vessel development in the mouse embryo, and knowing that VEGF was a HIF target, and appreciating that the early embryo exists in a naturally low O2 environment, we asked, is HIF regulating VEGF levels in the early embryo and therefore regulating vascular differentiation? And if so, how? So these data are now approximately a decade old. We carried out these studies by making mice that lacked various components of the HIF pathway. And these are day 9 mouse embryos. These are the same embryos surrounded by their yolk sac. This is sort of an extra embryonic membrane that supports the embryo. And the dissection of the first litter showed that indeed we can see vascular defects. So this is a wild-type yolk sac. You can see a nice vascular network in the yolk sac. And this is an embryo that lacks HIF activity. It was very obvious that the system was going to be important for normal vessel differentiation. And if you look at this in cross-section, so you mathematicians in the audience may not see data like this very frequently, but we've simply sectioned through the embryo. Here's the embryo, and then here's that extra embryonic membrane. And in the wild-type situation, you can see very obvious vessels being present. They're clearly abnormal in the absence of HIF. And we could also look at the recruitment of those additional cell types, such as smooth muscle cells and parasites. Here's nice smooth muscle cell and parasite deposition of a wild-type vessel. And these aberrant and large vessels had many fewer smooth muscle cells recruited. So these and a large number of studies over the next decade, whether we were looking at embryos that lack HIF-1 alpha or its dimerization partner known as ARNT, revealed that the naturally low O2 environment of the early embryo is activating HIF, and that you need HIF for virtually every step of cardiovascular differentiation. You need HIF to generate an intact heart. You need HIF for multiple steps of vessel differentiation. I won't show you the data. You needed HIF to generate normal numbers of both hematopoietic stem cells in early progenitors, and HIF was critical for proper placental morphogenesis. Therefore, the entire oxygen delivery system is in turn regulated by oxygen availability. And again, I think this makes sense. I have a question.
Is there anything that is normal in this knockout mouse?
Well, so that's a very excellent point, and you're bringing up the question, with all these defects, what is really a direct consequence of the absence of HIP? And so I'd like to show you how we've begun to look at that, but there are things that are normal. The neural tube begins to form in a normal fashion. Now remember, these embryos die by about day 10, and so many events of organogenesis haven't begun to take place. And I'll show you some genetic tricks we can begin to employ to look at later stages of embryonic differentiation. But your question is excellent. With so many abnormalities, what is simply a consequence of embryonic wasting because the oxygen and nutrient delivery system, especially the placenta, is aberrant? So since I got the question, what I can begin to do is tell you how we've addressed those questions. And we can begin, the embryo tells us that in vivo, in a physiologic situation, this pathway is important. But because of the complexity, how can I answer your question? And we've been able to do that by modeling this in cell-based assays based on, for example, differentiating embryonic stem cells, where we can look at early hematopoietic and angiogenic events outside of the context of placentation and show exactly the molecular pathways that are engaged. And we've just recently published an explant assay that directly answers your question. I'll show that in a moment, but those kinds of things were absolutely necessary to answer that very important question. So I think it's a very good point. And I wanted to show you these recent explant experiments because I think that these are the kinds of things that maybe people in the audience could partner up with experimentalists, because I think they're more amenable to biochemical and mathematical and engineering principles than studying the complexity of the embryo, especially when it's attached to the placenta. Okay? So those studies many years ago led to this hypothesis that has been guiding my laboratory ever since, and that is that just like a growing solid tumor, and Louisa brought up the point that Howard's talked about what happens with tumors that are initially avascular, that they can only get to be a couple of cubic millimeters in size, if that's the way they form. And at this point, the availability of oxygen via diffusion becomes limiting in such a way that cells internal to the tumor are oxygen deprived. We know that they activate HIF. We can see it accumulate. And HIF, in turn, turns on genes like VEGF, and this recruits vessels into the tumor. This is absolutely essential for the continued growth and subsequent metastasis of these neoplasms. And again, this is only one way that this occurs. This is, I think, canonical tumor angiogenesis, but there's also ways that this can occur, which is so-called vessel co-option by tumors, where tumors actually grow towards the vasculature and co-opt the vessels there. But I think that tumor angiogenesis, as schematized here, is very typical of what happens in things like epithelial carcinomas, which frequently start as avascular structures. Any comments, Louisa? Would you agree with that? Although this is not the only way it occurs, right? So we'll agree that much. But this, which you know, has been discussed by people like Judah Folkman since the 1970s, seems somewhat similar to what we think happens in the early embryo, and that is you have the low O2 environment of the uterus, and then the rapidly proliferating cells in the gastrulating embryo also creating hypoxic niches, shown here as light blue cells. We know we can do this now with these embryos. We can reveal these cells by things called hypoxia probes using pimidazole staining. We can reveal hypoxic subdomains in these embryos. Those are absolutely coincident with HIF activity, i.e. HIF accumulation, and superimposable with the cells that are expressing high levels of VEGF. The knockout work with embryos that lack either HIF-1 alpha or ARNT shows that if you interfere with that, you don't get the properly vascularized embryo, yolk sac, or a heart, or a hematopoietic system, or a placenta. So, pretty important.
Yeah, I wonder if, like, so in the example from Maryland,
Like, I'm wondering if the same thing happened in the mammary gland.
Probably. In fact, yes. So, because the mice that lacked either ARNT or HIF-1 alpha died by day 10 and a half, it wasn't possible to really look at those things using global knockouts. But now it's possible to do this with conditional alleles. So we can turn on and off these genes now with genetic tricks when and where we want. And if you knock out HIF at other stages of mammary gland differentiation, obviously this would normally be done in the adult, you see mammary morphogenesis disrupted, you see mammary vascular content disrupted. This is not my work, this is the work of Randy Johnson. And so given the early lethality of the global deletions, Randy's lab has created a conditional allele for HIF-1 alpha, we've created conditional alleles for both ARNT and HIF-2 alpha, and we're beginning to look at those things over and over again in other situations where we believe low O2 is affecting things like vessel morphogenesis and other things. Okay? So let's look at the vascular defects in more detail. So this is using PCAM immunohistochemistry. So simply we're using an antibody against an endothelial surface protein to look at the vascular content of these wild-type and mutant embryos in a little bit more detail. These are the wild-type and mutant yolk sacs. And these purpley areas represent the vascular tree of regions such as the head. If you look at this higher magnification, these are the somites. These are the structures that give rise to muscles. And you see vessel development. These are the so-called intersemitic vessels. And it was very obvious, once again, that the embryos that lack HIF activity had profoundly affected vessel development, in particular in the cranial region, in the somites. And if we look at the yolk sac, even though the vessels are present, they're not being properly remodeled. And so, again, even though it's very hard to say absolutely, our idea has been that the earliest events of vessel differentiation, i.e. vasculogenesis, may be intact. It's the fine-tuning and the remodeling that HIF really works on, but as you'll see, that's an oversimplification. So coming back to the question that I got, which is a very valid question, with so many things going wrong, how much of this is really a direct consequence of HIF activity acting on the vessels or vascular progenitors, and how much of this is perhaps simply downstream of the poorly formed placenta, so that the whole embryo is just falling apart. So this allows me to introduce an explant system that I actually think would be very amenable to some of these mathematical models that you folks might be interested in developing. And many of the early hematopoietic and vascular precursors reside in a region of the embryo called the AGM. That stands for the aorta, gonad, and mesonephrus. This is a curled up day 9 and a half mouse embryo, and I've simply outlined it here with a dotted line, and this region of the embryo will go on to make that large vessel known as the aorta, the nascent kidney, or the mesonephron, and the very beginning determinants of the gonad. So it's called the AGM region. It also is called the para-aortic splenopleural domain. And in addition to being an important source of vascular progenitors, the work of Elaine Zierzak and others has shown that this is an important embryonic source of very early hematopoietic stem cells. In fact, hematopoietic stem cells from this region are the predominant source of cells that go on to seed the fetal liver as the embryo continues to develop. So this is a good region of the embryo to look at those early events that bring about both hematopoiesis and angiogenesis. And so we can perform explant cultures, simply dissecting out these very small structures, and they're put on a support layer of cells called OP9 cells. And I showed you some HIF mutant embryos that looked really bad. But not all of the embryos looked that bad, and so we took extra care to use developmentally identical wild-type and mutant embryos. They were similar sized. We could stage match them by counting the somites. And so we tried to obtain these AGM regions from wild type and HIF mutant embryos that were virtually identical in terms of cell number and viable cell content. And so now we put them on this support cell and provide them with additional cytokines such as IL-3 and IL-6, and look at their ability to generate both non-adherent cells. These turn on to be hematopoietic cells because they're specific for expressing pan-hematopoietic markers. They make vascular beds, so from this explant as shown here, there's a proliferating wave of endothelial cells called the so-called vascular bed, which we think mimics the earliest events of vasculogenesis, and then at the edges, they begin to form these vascular networks, and we think that this is a nice in vitro mimic of angiogenesis. And then further studies of these explants by other markers, such as antibodies that detect a smooth muscle antigen called smooth muscle actin, shows that they will also ultimately recruit those additional cell types, parasites and smooth muscle cells. And so we thought that we could use this system to ask your question, is this really a direct effect on vascular events or downstream of other embryonic malaise, if you will? I have a question back here. So you can begin to see this in the first 7 days. This begins to happen from about days 5 to 14. This we see by at least day 8, and it continues. This is a 14-day culture system. But it's turned out to be quite useful for us.
Have you checked for tissue factor, you know, progranulin?
So we haven't looked specifically for that, but given that we see all these things happening, I suggest that they must be present. Remember, we're taking something from the embryo, which has all the complicated factors and regulators present. And now we're taking it out of the embryo and then looking at their developmental capacities in vitro. So we're watching what will happen in vitro, but you have to remember that this is really a snapshot of developmental potential in vivo, if that's clear. Okay? All right. So when we did this, as we might have hoped for, the wild type and mutant explants clearly exhibited both hematopoietic and endothelial defects. So at a higher phase contrast micrograph here, you see all these non-adherent cells. Those turn out to be hematopoietic cells. Here you can see this is an unstable phase contrast explant. If we now once again do PCAM immunostaining, and I think this is a particularly beautiful one, I think you can see these vascular beds and then these rings of these beautiful complicated arborized vascular networks. In contrast, these are the two examples of wild type explants. And you see once again, we very nicely recapitulated this profound vascular defect. In fact, it should be noted that not only do we have a defect in vessel network formation, vessel bed formation is somewhat diminished, suggesting that even though the early embryos themselves couldn't tell us, we're probably seeing not only effects on angiogenic remodeling, but even effects on the earliest events, i.e. vascular genesis. So I'm showing you a picture of an ARNT mutant explant here with a few vessels, but these were very rare. Frequently didn't get anything at all. I'm just showing an example of one of the better ones. So a profound hematopoietic and vascular defect revealed by performing these para-aortic splenic pleural explants. So why do we have so few hematopoietic cells? Well, coming back to something that was discussed in the first presentation, embryonic development in the case of mammals does involve some finite number of apoptotic events. You do need both cell growth and cell death for organogenesis, and this is a day 9 embryo in cross-section. We're revealing apoptotic cells using tunnel assays, and so here you can see some tunnel positive cells in the wild type embryos. Here we're now looking at mutant embryos, and I think it's even easier to see with this version of the tunnel assay. And I've outlined the AGM region, and I've also used arrows to indicate the dorsal aorta. And what was very interesting in the absence of HIF is that there was an increased number of apoptotic cells in the dorsal aorta when we compared the HIF mutant to the wild type embryos. So even though these embryos normally have some evidence of apoptosis, there were many more dorsal aorta associated cells that were clearly dying. interest, we can reveal this by flow cytometry as well. And please feel free to ask me if you'd like to know more about that. So, as I said, we think that hematopoiesis and vascular development are tightly linked, and showing in the embryo that many of the early hematopoietic cells had a survival problem, they were clearly dying, we wondered if in fact these early vascular defects might be downstream of the death of the hematopoietic cells, because it would appear that HIF activity is essential for maintaining these early hematopoietic cells in a viable state. I can molecularly explain that because VEGF, while promoting vessel survival and differentiation, is essential for maintaining hematopoietic stem cell viability. That's been shown by Napoleon Ferrara. So, if you don't have HIF and you have lower levels of VEGF in the hematopoietic compartment, therefore those hematopoietic cells are dying, can that at least at some level explain these gross vascular defects? And so we address this by now purifying hematopoietic cells, and we're using cells that express at least one of these stem or progenitor markers called SCA, and we're obtaining these from GFP-positive wild-type mice, and now adding them back to these explant cultures. And again, here's a nice wild-type explant, beautiful beds, beautiful networks, everything looks great. Here's the mutant explant, looks terrible. Now, we provide wild-type GFP-positive hematopoietic cells. We completely rescue the vascular defects, both vasculogenesis and angiogenesis. And we didn't do this just by looking at it. We obviously undertook morphometry to show, these asterisks show vessel lengths when we can get them in the mutant explants, and now they've been very nicely rescued with the exogenous hematopoietic cells to the point that they're statistically identical. There's no statistical difference between vessel length of the wild-type explants and those that have been rescued with exogenous hematopoietic progenitors. So what this says is we've been able to show that there's a relationship between the hematopoietic system, vasculogenesis, and angiogenesis, and in fact, these vascular defects we've been appreciating for a decade may in fact be downstream of the hematopoietic defect that we knew existed. Do the hematopoietic cells contribute to the vasculature themselves? There's a lot of interest in this in neovascular events. In fact, so-called endothelial progenitor cells or other bone marrow resident cells can be mobilized and in fact become physically incorporated into vessels, whether they're part of the endothelium or perivascular structures. So we looked at this in our explant system. The donor hematopoietic cells are tagged with GFP. We've stained the vasculature, and I think you might be able to see that with dye I. And the important take-home point here is that the donor GFP-positive cells are not co-staining with the dye I. So what I'm saying is that while the hematopoietic cells are directing angiogenesis and vasculogenesis for that matter, it's not because they're actually becoming physically incorporated into the vasculature. This is an important point. This may actually be a distinction between embryonic vascular events and pathophysiologic adult vascular events, where it's clear that hematopoietic cells will physically become incorporated. So what's the problem? As I said, VEGF is an important HIF target, and I'll just direct you to this panel. We're looking for VEGF protein by immunohistochemistry, and in particular, the hematopoietic cells in the dorsal aorta shown here, the few that we get have much less VEGF protein, as shown either by immunohistochemistry or now another assay based on ELISA, as it's called. Again, the take-home message is that the HIF mutant embryos have less VEGF, and we would have expected this because VEGF is an important HIF target. So we've been able to rescue the vascular defect with exogenous hematopoietic cells. Is that because the AGM region doesn't have proper levels of VEGF? And we think the hematopoietic cells are an important paracrine source of VEGF for these early vessels. So we looked at this by now simply providing exogenous VEGF. So here's some wild type, lovely vascular networks, and here's some null, virtually indistinguishable. So just like the hematopoietic cells provided rescue, VEGF can take the place of the early hematopoietic cells. There are other HIF targets that could be important, such as angiopoietin 1. And while angiopoietin 1, as shown here, does promote endothelial cell proliferation, you can see that the vessels are highly congested. And so they don't rescue the way VEGF does. In fact, angiopoietin creates an abnormal situation. And so what we're arguing is that the early hematopoietic cells are an important source of VEGF, which is absolutely essential for multiple vascular differentiation phenomena, that HIF-deficient early hematopoietic cells in the AGM region express much less VEGF, and this leads to the severely compromised vascular content of these HIF-deficient embryos. And we think we've been able to nicely model this in this explant system, and this was absolutely essential to answer your question. And I think this goes a long way towards answering your question. It's still not perfect. What we're now doing, and this is thanks to some help from Louisa, is now we're taking things like HIF-1 aren't out of the picture cell by cell. Again, we're deleting these genes in each of these different cell types to ask when and where they become important. And that, again, allows us to get around the problem of all the cells not having HIF, and so multiple problems being encountered. So I'll summarize this portion of the talk by saying that these aren't mutant, that is, HIF-deficient explants exhibit defective vasculogenesis, angiogenesis, and hematopoiesis, that the embryos clearly produce much less VEGF protein, whether we look at this in sections of tissues or simply grind up the whole embryo and ask for molecules by ELISA assay, that these defects are all rescued by simply adding exogenous SCA1-positive hematopoietic cells. Now, the SCA1-positive hematopoietic cell population will include stem cells, but it's not limited to stem cells. So I want to make that point. If we wanted to say that this was a hematopoietic stem cell-based phenomenon, we'd have to do further purifications. But for practical reasons, we simply went for the stem/progenitor pool, simply those cells that express SCA1, and that these defects are also rescued by exogenous VEGF. And so coming back to this diagram, which we believe is the case, and we believe we'll be able to show exactly how HIF directs cardiogenesis, vascular differentiation, hematopoiesis, et cetera, is by now knocking it out cell by cell. And we could do this in a conditional way so that we can knock out this molecule or components of this pathway at specific times during differentiation and in specific cells. And those experiments will have to continue. And what I'd like to leave you with regard to HIF, we're beginning to think that, at least with regard to the embryo, or at least the vascular defects associated with that para-aortic splanchnopleural pleural domain, that the vascular defects, in fact, may be downstream of the hematopoietic defects, and highlighting the important relationship between these two organ systems, where they really can't develop one without the other. So I've shown you, and I'm not the only one who have to show this, that early hematopoietic cells are an important paracrine source of molecules like VEGF and angiopoietin 1, critical for early vascular differentiation. But the vasculature, in turn, is an important source of hematopoietic stem cells. So similarly, in the AGM region, it's thought that the earliest hematopoietic stem cells are in close association with the vasculature. In fact, they may bud off from the earliest endothelial cells. So there's a close relationship between these two. There's a reason why they develop in tandem, and this is one explanation for that. I'm almost out of time. I'm just going to show a few more slides, and then I'm going to stop, and I'd be happy to take lots of questions and certainly suggestions and comments. But I've discussed this process as a pathway that involves HIF-1-alpha dimerized with ARN. Well, it's not that simple. There are two highly related alpha subunits, HIF-1-alpha and HIF-2-alpha. They have a high degree of amino acid identity. They're both regulated based on oxygen availability that is very hard to detect under high levels of O2, and these proteins accumulate to higher and higher levels as O2 levels go down. Now, HIF-1-alpha mutant embryos have all the defects I've just described. Embryos that lack HIF-2-alpha also have a a variety of cardiovascular defects. They have defects in lung maturation. They have other vascular deficiencies. They die of bradycardia. So while these have cardiovascular defects, however, they're not identical to those embryos that lack HIF1. And we've been putting a lot of effort into identifying HIF1 specific versus HIF2 specific targets. And we've been able to show that while they regulate a number of genes in concert, HIF2 alpha, in fact, in a head-to-head comparison with HIF1, is a more potent activator of VEGF. In fact, HIF2 alpha uniquely regulates other factors such as TGF alpha. And we've recently published something that we're quite excited about. HIF2 will regulate the levels of an important stem cell factor called OG4. So they do have unique transcriptional targets. They also do not have identical patterns of expression. So this is RNA and C2 hybridization of embryonic brains, showing that virtually all the cells have HIF1 alpha mRNA, and therefore are capable of expressing the HIF1 alpha protein if they become oxygen starved. HIF2 alpha mRNA has this punctate pattern of expression, and that's because in the early embryo, they're expressed. It is expressed almost exclusively in the vasculature. And the last slide I'm going to show, and then I'll stop, is that when we think about tumor progression, when we compare tumors that express HIF1 versus tumors that express HIF2, and we've done this in a knock-in experiment, which I could elaborate on later if anybody's interested, I think you can see something very obvious. The HIF2 expressing tumors are larger, they grow much more rapidly, they're highly vasculature. When we analyze VEGF levels in these tumors, it was significantly higher. They had increased vascular density. They had many more proliferating cells, as evidenced by expression of proliferating cell markers like Ki-67. And when excised, they were much larger. And so while there's been considerable interest on the role of HIF1 in things like tumor angiogenesis, we're beginning to believe that in some contexts, a related factor called HIF2 is going to be an even bigger problem, because it more potently produces tumor angiogenesis and molecules like VEGF. And the thing that we're particularly excited about is that while HIFs, whether it's HIF1 or HIF2, and oxygen availability, we think are going to be important to virtually every step of tumor progression, whether it's the ability of tumor cells to survive the naturally hypoxic microenvironment of the tumor, to recruit blood vessels, to break down the surrounding matrix and become invasive or metastatic. Because HIF2 can regulate stem cell factors like OG4, these molecules may have a very important role to play in the maintenance of a so-called cancer stem cell, another new way of thinking about tumor progression. And so there's a lot of interest in the HIFs in both normal and abnormal vascular phenomena, and I think this is something folks in the audience should bear in mind when they think about their models. It's just remembering microenvironmental cues that regulate or promote vascular differentiation and oxygen availability, I think, being one very important one to bear in mind. So I will stop there. I won't stroke through all the other slides I thought about showing. But I'll just mention the people in the lab that contributed these studies. Kelly Covello and Brian Keith did the work on HIF1 versus HIF2. And the work on the hematopoietic and endothelial differentiation phenomena in the AGM region was largely done by Deanna Ramirez and Anya Rumi in my laboratory. So I'll stop there and take any questions. Showing explants. Right. So the embryos that lack this pathway will not live beyond day 10. And that's why we took out these explants at least a day before that. taking care to make sure that they were identical visually in terms of cell numbers, and then we allowed them to continue to differentiate in an in vitro system. And I wanted to show that system because I think this is something that could be useful in modeling these early phenomena. One of the reasons why mouse embryos, so this is a limitation of mouse embryos, zebrafish, frog, avian systems are much more amenable to these early embryonic analyses and manipulations. What's attractive about the mouse system is we have the ability to do nice reverse genetics using gene targeting, or now the more up-to-date technology based on double-stranded RNA, for example. And it is a mammal, and I think to fully understand all the things we're talking about, we need to look at this in multiple model organisms, be it fish, fly, you know, fly having something like a vasculature, i.e. the trachea, avian, and mammalian context.
Any other questions?
Good question. One thing I should mention is that while HIF1 and HIF2 are frequently found at the protein level in a broad spectrum of solid tumors, there have been no mutations in either locus that have been correlated thus far with tumor progression, and it would be interesting to look at that in non-solid tumors such as hematologic malignancies. There is a point mutation in HIF. One that Frank Lee has just described that doesn't lead to a malignancy thus far, but it does lead to erythrocytosis. So another target that I didn't mention is erythropoietin. And a point mutation in HIF itself may lead to more abundant activity, higher levels of EPO, and a hematologic pathology. But so far, I don't know of anything really pointing to neoplastic situations, but again, anything that involves a solid structure, I think will have either protein or frequently both, and it's going to be an important part of the picture.
Okay, Andy and Charlie?
Right. So that is looking. So the way Deanna did this is, you know, we have this big, these are six well plates with vessels coming out. So she microscopically went to 10 different fields and counted on average 10 vessel lengths using morphometry. And that was the overall average. But you're absolutely right. It is quite heterogeneous, but that's trying to get an average. And there were pretty substantial standard errors and mean, but it gives you, at least tries to give a quantitative picture of what's going on, other than simply looking at it and go, oh, what's that? That's the best we could do, but I'm open to suggestions.
Sure. Yeah, I think there's computer systems that
go. There are. We did it by morphometry, but there are much better programs, and we're going to start trying to use them.
Right. So the in the AGM work, if you take wild type AGMs and you reduce them down to some appropriately low level of oxygen tension, do they sort of recapitulate what you saw?
So we haven't done that. We'd like to do that. The reason why we didn't introduce hypoxia into our system is that we're trying to use the AGM that we take out as a snapshot of developmental properties of the embryo itself. And so if you put these, if we take our mutant cultures or even our wild type cultures and put them in our low O2, we're going to totally,
no.
For example, the OP9 cells themselves will start making more VEGF. But what we did do, though, which I didn't show, to show that VEGF is absolutely required, and I don't think anybody will be shocked by this, is we introduced FLIP-FC. So we soaked up the VEGF and we completely phenocopied the arginine and X-plane appearance.
So I think that it's possible that you've got a great model of extra embryonic why not? I mean, because there's no blood cells there early on, right, in vitro and beyond.
No, there are. The AGM has the earliest, so I wanna emphasize that that explant is the early embryo, a portion of the early embryo itself, which is known to have early hematopoietic cells. When those things are purified, you can use those to rescue lethally irradiated mice. They are a good source of early hematopoietic stem cells.
Yeah, maybe I'm just stating myself.
Okay.
So early embryos prior to circulation have no there are no blood cell precursors intra-embryonically. That's just a fact. They're extra-embryonic. It's
not true. It's certainly the stem cells are there because you can take that embryo, that explant, and purify.
What, these are not 8, 7.5?
These are day 9.
Mm-hmm.
They're there by functional assays. And you may be seeing a discrepancy between the mouse embryo and the avian system. While the circulation is just beginning at this point, I would agree.
Right.
That is an important intraembryonic source of early hematopoietic cells.
I think it's. But my point was that if you take the allantoides off if you take your the allantoids off the arm,
mm-hmm.
and you put that down in culture like Karen Holmes and Chris
right.
Craig do, does that engage in vasculogenesis, or have you done that?
So we have not done any of the work with the allantoids. Actually, your former colleague is one of the people, and Karen Downs, I think is her name.
Correct.
And they would argue that that's a great model of vasculogenesis as well. We have not looked at the allantois ourselves. But that's a different structure than what I'm...
No, I know it is. I was just trying to make a distinction because early on there's this primary vascular network form.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be modeled well by the allantois. I mean, it seems to recapitulate a lot of those things. And
mm-hmm.
then after that, getting near circulation stages, then there's a lot of similarities between the extra-embryonic events where there were always blood islands, right?
Right.
And now the embryo sort of catches up
right.
and starts recognizing the fact that it too is going to eventually have to make blood cells and so forth. That's the point I was trying to make, the sort
right.
of operational definition early on.
Right. No, I think your point's excellent. I think this, you know, relationship has been long appreciated in extra-embryonic situations. That there's a blood island and this close association
mm-hmm.
between early hematopoietic cells and early angioblasts.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody's comfortable with that. Multiple model systems. And Gordon Keller's hemangioblast so far has only been unequivocally shown to see the yolk sac. He hasn't been able to show that same progenitor pool is part of the AGM. But I think in the last 5 to 8 years, the AGM as an important source of both hematopoietic stem cells and early angioblasts that make up the vasculature of the embryo proper, I think is what a number of labs are working on, such as the Suda lab, Elaine Zierzak, Nancy Spector, to name a few. And so we took advantage of some of their experimental systems to address, you know, try to explain the phenomena we've been seeing for some time. Transcribed and transcribed. those hydroxylation events. And then when they begin to be less, now unhydroxylated can begins to accumulate and goes to the nucleus.
So all those words are even being read biology words.
They're not very mathematical.
Well, it's not like they're telling you mathematics, we haven't got to mathematics yet. We're talking about human chemistry today or even molecular mechanics. So what is it about the presence or absence of 208 through somewhere on that protein that prevents it from interacting or activating or whatever those words are? Now, we're really talking about molecular bonds or conformational changes,
yes,
which now in a mechanical immune sense are spins.
Right.
So I mean, I know there, this discussion, can go a lot further, but maybe today, while you're here, just talk a little bit about the molecular events that are changing these molecules and their attempts to interact.
Right, so this has been crystallized, at least a portion of it, and those hydroxylation events change the conformation face of HIF that allows it to be recognized by von Hippel-Lindau. You need von Hippel-Lindau.
It recognizes another fungal.
They stick.
Yeah,
they stick together.
So that is discussion in studio. Otherwise, it interacts, it recognizes, what does this protein do? But it sticks. It sticks or doesn't stick.
Right.
And I think, that's the issue that we really want to get to with molecular mechanics at this level, protein measurement.
Right.
I have a comment. I would argue that if you knew every single molecular and atomic detail, you wouldn't have any idea how vascular genesis.
Yeah, but I wouldn't know why it interact with this other molecule.
Yeah, you would.
But I think
the cell integrates a lot of signals, right? And then it has a behavior. So if you want to model vascular genesis, I think you can do that without knowing the atomic.
Absolutely, you can. You can't get to the nanoscale and know what happens just by looking at the pictures.
So it depends on what length scale you're modeling.
I just said nanoscale.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay,
on that note, may I take just one more?
Sure. The AGM, I was just wondering if you've done any comparative work to see how the explanted AGM functions relative to the intact version, finer sections of the embryo and days later than day 9,
right,
just to see if their courses deviate on account of the explanted. Have you looked at that, or has anybody looked at that?
Well, so our problem is we can't do it with our current genetic models because our embryos die one day later. What you could do, and this is being done very nicely, is introducing changes to the endogenous loci, some of these regulators.
I mean, even the wild type.
Right, right. Right, right. So tag the cells that we're interested in so that we can do lineage tracing in vivo in the wild type case. And
mm-hmm.
those kinds of things are ongoing in multiple labs. The best way, we think, is to, by gene targeting, introduce things that help us visualize this, like GFP, for example, or other markers right into the loci that we think regulate these things, and then we can watch the cells
mm-hmm.
make the changes in vivo.
So that's, would you take another one?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to show people when I have lunch.
So one of the factors that drives early angiogenesis, as well as stem cell renewal, is sonic hedgehog.
Correct.
And I wondered if you've looked at the expression of this molecule in your head spot.
No, I haven't. That can be done very nicely. I think this brings up a really important point. We're having our hands full just looking at the HIF pathway. I've mentioned an intersection with other important differentiation regulatory systems. I mentioned NOT4. HIF1 also intersects the Notch pathway, which is going to be very interesting. At this point, I don't know that it necessarily intersects Wnt or sonic hedgehog, but those all are things that are going on in parallel. And I think the system would be great for looking at that, but we haven't